Hi, folks, and welcome to White Collar Week. It's the isolation that destroys us. The solution is in community. Today on the podcast, we have Jim Campbell, a radio host and journalist based in Greenwich, Connecticut, who has a nationally syndicated business affairs show called Business Talk with Jim Campbell. He also hosts another show, Forensic Talk, that dives into the world of financial crimes. It's probably not a surprise to learn that Jim and I are friends and that he has interviewed me for both of his shows. Today we turn the tables and Jim the interviewer becomes Jim the guest as we talk about his book, Madoff Talks, uncovering the untold story behind the most notorious Ponzi scheme in history. Jim's book will be published next year, and he is now putting the finishing touches on his multi-year dialogue with Bernie Madoff while in prison, Bernie's wife Ruth Madoff, and Bernie's late son Andrew Madoff, as well as government investigators, attorneys, witnesses, and most importantly, the victims. While Jim has culled over 400 pages of emails with Bernie Madoff and presents Madoff's words verbatim, he never accepts any of it at face value. Jim investigates the truth behind the man, the family, the fraud, and the systemic breakdown of the SEC, banks, and every watchdog that had the obligation and opportunity to uncover and stop the fraud before more people got hurt, but failed. The Bernie Madoff story was and remains one of the biggest tales of corruption and greed that Wall Street has ever known, and certainly the largest Ponzi scheme in history. And we have an inside look right here today. Jim, welcome to White Collar Week.
I'm glad to be here, and it is a switch for me to be on the other side of the mic, so I'm looking forward to this.
Thanks. You know, it's possible that you can actually run this on your show as well.
We are going to, yes.
It's so interesting. Jim, I think the way we should go here is let's learn a little bit about you, some of your background, you know, where you grew up and what and how you came into being a journalist. And from there, we can kind of get into what intrigued you enough to devote, obviously, a lot of your life, a big portion of your life, to researching Bernie Madoff. Is that good for you?
Yeah, thank you very much. And as I said, I appreciate the opportunity. Madoff Talks, uncovering the truth behind the most notorious Ponzi scheme in history. So we're kind of excited about it. And in fact, writing your first book is a brutal experience. And I am within the finish line, is in my sight. Next Friday, August 7th, I will turn in the manuscript. And I had written 150,000 words, which McGraw-Hill felt was 50,000 too many. And so I have been in the process of trying to figure out how to make all those cuts and everything. So it's an interesting process. It's like running a marathon, not how you'd expect the whole thing to go, but it ends up, you know, it's a lot of fun. It took me a lot of years, obviously, because I had to establish the relationship with Madoff. But to go back to me a little bit, it's an interesting thing, you know, how I ended up doing this. And I should say our other show is Forensic Talk, which is also syndicated on some stations. And as I say, often business and crime are interrelated, as you know, actually yourself too.
That's how I make my living, Jim.
Yeah. We've had Jeff on both shows. So
that's right.
It works out well. And by the way, I must say that nobody works harder than you, and you know how to build niches. And obviously, you know how to turn around your life. So that's all very inspirational, too. You should do an autobiography, I guess. It would be fascinating. I think you have written something, right?
Yeah, but we'll talk about that next time.
Okay. All right. You know, how did I get in this business? Because it is interesting in the sense that I don't know how it happened almost. I went to business school after Tufts at Dartmouth and just intended to work in the business world my whole life. And in fact, I went to IBM right out of Tuck in 1979, where I met my wife at IBM. She's the only thing that I kept out of IBM. In fact, she's still working there even. And I did some other jobs over time, some entrepreneurial, some back into the corporate world. And how this emerged, radio, is that I had a vending business. And I heard, so I would hear going out to see customers talk radio all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I listened to it and I said, there's no show that is more objective, that presents facts, that presents both sides, that isn't ideologically driven. Mm-hmm. And it just used to kind of drive me nuts. And then I hear there's this thing called the Connecticut School of Broadcasting.
Right.
And my wife is the one that can make instant decisions. I kind of procrastinate. I told her about it. And I said, you know, maybe I should go to a class sometime. When do you think I should do it? She says, right now. And I did. I went right away to the next class. And timing ended up being perfect because I was the only guy in the class that had any interest in business. And it was the 2008 financial crash. Hmm. And so I come out of that. And, you know, nobody really understood, including me, until I studied it, what actually happened. What were collateralized debt obligations and derivatives and credit default swaps? And how did Wall Street totally implode? And how did all of a sudden the mortgage business collapse and people's houses and people's IRAs? And so I did a show starting off. A lot of the episodes were on various components, Bear Stearns, Citibank, Lehman Brothers, AIG, and the whole crisis. And we went through it over and over in every different angle and everything. And it kind of grew from that. I started coming out of Connecticut School of Broadcasting. I wanted to get some practice somewhere. And it turns out that Yale University has a really tremendous radio station and facilities, and an AM station that is number one in rhythm and blues in New Haven, a for-profit station. And they allow two community members a year to join the station and have a show. And the rest, mm-hmm. obviously, are students at Yale. And they let me come on, and that's where I kind of learned my chops. They liked me so much that the board allowed me to extend. You're only allowed to stay for like 2 years. And they allowed me to basically extend as long as I wanted to. And then the next step came when, you know, I'm from Greenwich, and the Greenwich station had a need. And Jeff Weber is the was the station manager then. At the same time, he was the national manager of the Business Talk radio network, which was syndicated over 300 stations at the time. And he brought me to the WGCH, and then he let me syndicate. And so suddenly I was somehow got into radio, somehow got into Yale radio station, WYBC, then WGCH, where I ended up becoming assistant news director under Tony Savino. And then business talk with Jim Campbell went on the syndicated route. And I pride myself in people often saying it's the best interview they've had. And that's not a reflection of me. It's a reflection of the fact that I do prep and I read the books. And they're always thrilled when I can ask a question where it's obvious I've read the book. Mm-hmm. And it allows them, it brings them out. And, you know, if you're on NBC, the Today Show, or CNBC, those guys don't have time to read the books.
No, and they've got
5 minutes to do the interviews. Mm-hmm. So it's like they're one shot to be able to get an in-depth interview, and they enjoy it. I really enjoy it. And, you know, my first big interview, I was the first guy to get an interview with Elliot Spitzer after he was ousted and resigned as the governor of New York.
Wow. And
when that happened, the amount of web internet hits around that scandal at that time was the biggest in the history of the internet. And then, of course, he went radio silent.
Yeah.
And a guy that had written a book on him, an investigative reporter from Fortune, had been to Princeton with him. And Spitzer cooperated because he was hoping to come back to politics.
Yeah, of course.
And he said to him afterwards, you're looking to do this. You know, Jim does long-form interviews. And he did the first interview with me.
That's
right. He let me. And by the way, a brilliant guy. He would have been the first Jewish president in the U.S. History if he had not imploded.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a sad story. But, you know, I asked him every question, and he's a combative type A type of guy. Mm-hmm. He actually, we were doing the show live then, and I called them because I wanted to make sure I'd get them, you know. It's kind of nerve-wracking live. You wait, hope they call. Mm-hmm. Well, I couldn't even dial him before he was calling in saying, well, I'm ready. Where are you? I'm ready. Let's go.
Well, he was under a lot of pressure to tell his side of the story, I'm sure. It was a very lopsided difficult time for him and his family, that's for sure.
And let me tell you, his family, his wife and his kids are outstanding people.
Yeah, beautiful.
People. I'll tell you the sad thing about Elliot, and you could relate to this probably because you've been able to do it. If you have that big a fall, you have to humble yourself. You have to say, okay, this is what I got to do to learn. This is what I got to do to change. And you really have to go down almost right to the ground.
Exactly.
It's like a drug addiction, right? Until you totally give in. And he never really was able to do that.
Yeah.
It was just too much. So if you notice, his comebacks didn't work.
Right.
And his marriage fell apart. And he continued to do kind of dumb things for a guy that's utterly brilliant.
Yeah.
And I liked him. And he stayed in touch with me. And you know, he'd often respond right away if I, you know.
Sure.
He did a show. He got a show on, I think, CNN or something, right, with a woman.
Yeah.
And I thought he was really obnoxious. He was interrupting her. He's just too type A, right? So I would text him during the show and say, Elliot, stop it. You know, this is a medium of calm. And you've got to be able to have a conversation with her and not just talk over her and whatever. And he listened sometimes and most of the time probably didn't. Anyway, as you can see, it's all sort of unplanned and everything because I was a business guy and everything. But I, you know, I like this. I thought about going into politics a little bit, and my experience in Greenwich, it wasn't good. There was just, to be blunt, a lot of lying to you. You know, Greenwich is a closed system, RTC and DTC.
Sure.
And I didn't like the whole process, and I feel totally free in radio to do whatever I want, to present whatever I want, and I feel, you know, more unburdened. And I have to tell you the final thing is that Warren Buffett's my hero. And Warren Buffett really views his platform as the didactic platform, which is a teaching platform.
Yeah, yeah.
The making billions of dollars gives him credibility. Well, I wanted to do this in a similar type of education vein, which is if I could go in and teach, right? But this, I could get a wider audience. And if people don't understand what was going on in the financial crisis or don't understand this or that, that maybe give them a independent and objective and fact-based approach, almost like a teaching thing, but it's got to be entertainment. It's got to be interesting. You got to have guests like yourself that have really compelling stories. So that's a little bit about me. Probably not as exciting as your life, but what the heck.
Well, I definitely wanted you to give some background. And what I find interesting is that you're obviously a staple in Greenwich. You're someone who everybody knows in Greenwich. And Greenwich is a tough town. And it's people who are wealthy, entitled. It's probably a little more diverse than people know.
Yeah.
But there are people who are staunchly Republican and staunchly Democrat and they could be Republican and liberal. I mean, there's a lot of people who believe in social justice and have liberal values, but it doesn't necessarily align with their politics. And so you and I both lived in Greenwich, you for, I guess, your whole life, really, more most of your life. And so our paths crossed. And but Bernie Madoff has Greenwich ties, too. I think one of his sons lived in Greenwich, I think.
I think Andrew had a summer house here, and Ruth, his wife, ended up here.
Yeah, exactly.
After the whole thing went down, she actually moved in with her sister in Florida, which in and of itself is interesting because her sister and her sister's husband were bankrupted by Bernie. So obviously, if they felt Ruth was involved in that, they probably wouldn't have invited her to come live with them. But she did make the decision to move to Greenwich, and that is coincidental to the book as well because I got to know her.
Sure.
I don't know if you want to switch to Madoff, but I'll tell you how, again, just like radio came out of the blue, Madoff came out of the blue in the sense that I was doing an interview with a woman named Laurie Sandell, who wrote the only book that Andrew and his fiance, Catherine Hooper, cooperated with. And the night before I interviewed her, she said, if you want to do some background prep, I will connect you with Andrew Madoff. And so I call, and Andrew's not obviously going to come on the air because he's got lawsuits up the kazoo and everything.
Yeah, of course.
But he talked off the record. He answered every question I asked. I told him bluntly, I said, you bought a condo for $3 million just months before this thing went down. That money was obviously not your money. It was other people's money. It was Ponzi money. Shouldn't you be giving that money back to the SIPC trustee who was going around recovering money? Yeah. He said, absolutely, without even pausing. And he said, the only reason I haven't done it yet is he's suing us for every dime I have. And so we have to play that out because I earned some legitimate money and I, you know, that, et cetera. Anyway, I said, well, you know, I'm doing the interview tomorrow. I've talked to Diana Enriquez, who wrote the first Madoff book and used herself as Madoff's biographer. She was a New York Times financial reporter. And she and I both said we hadn't seen evidence that the kids were involved. At this point, everybody assumed the kids were involved. That's Andrew and Mark. And that Ruth must have known. So I told him, I haven't seen evidence yet of it. And, you know, I'm going to say that on the air tomorrow. And he says, well, I'm going to listen then and see if you're a person of your word. So he actually listened. And then the next day we're talking and he says, oh, you know, Ruth is moving to Greenwich. My mother's moving to Old Greenwich, to be exact. Yep. And I said, well, you know, I'll take her to lunch because no one's going to even want to talk to her in Old Greenwich, right? At this point in time. He said, okay. So we set up a lunch. It's in December. We go to the beach house on Sound Beach Avenue in Old Greenwich. And she's a very attractive woman, 75 years old, looks great. She arrives in sunglasses, and it's the middle of December. And she doesn't take them off in the restaurant.
Yeah.
And so she's obviously skittish about being seen, and because her face is obviously at that point very well recognized. Yeah. Anyway, she took the glasses off. She ate a salad, a Caesar salad, like she hadn't been fed. I mean, it was just, and I found her to be totally, totally open, totally honest. We had, it felt like instant chemistry. And then we're walking out and I say, Ruth, can I have a picture of us? She stops, freezes. You're wired, aren't you? And she thought I was a media guy and had taped the whole interview under the table and did not allow me to take the picture.
Yeah.
I had to tell Andrew that I had not done that and whatever. But anyway, over the course of several years, we had regular lunches and we got to be very close. And she's the one that introduced me to Bernie. Mm-hmm. Because Andrew wasn't talking to Bernie and Bernie still loved Andrew and everything. So when Ruth connected me, Ruth was having very little to do with him at that point, but she connected me. And I told him, was he
in prison yet? Was he in prison?
He was in prison in Butner, North Carolina, right. Medium security prison. Mm-hmm. And we were connected over this prison email system, which has to be approved by the warden and
Corlings.
And Bernie has to accept it, obviously.
Yeah.
And anyway, Bernie, so I said, you know, Bernie, I'm going to get the truth out of you or allow you to talk and allow you to explain your side. And then I'm going to vet it, obviously. And but I'm only going to do the truth. And, you know, if a book comes out of it, that's what we'll do. And he said, I will accept those terms because both Ruth and Andrew said you're sincere and all that kind of stuff. So that's how it started. We ended up with 400 pages of communications and brilliant, total recall, charismatic, low key, really, really kind of an amazing guy. Now, of course, all I got for those 400 pages was his side of the story, his perspective, a lot of detail, a lot of information or whatever. And then I said, well, Bernie, now I'm going to take a time out and if I can see if anybody's interested in buying the book. And we had trouble selling it initially, and I got a new agent who ended up being able to sell it inside of a week, signed mm-hmm. contract, and had other interest from Simon & Schuster at Random House and McGraw-Hill signed very quickly. But that was by then, several years after, and I had to go vet the other side of the story, right? I couldn't print a whole book as if it was the truth. And people will find out when the book is out how much of what Bernie told me ends up being the truth. And it's not necessarily a huge percentage. We're excited to announce that Jim Campbell Radio has now been unveiled on YouTube. You search Jim Campbell Radio. When you get there, please subscribe. You'll get all our updates. Content is regularly updated. And Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell and Business Talk with Jim Campbell, all of our podcasts are right there for you. All of this new consolidated data content updated regularly. Jim Campbell Radio.
Welcome to White Collar Week. We have a friend of mine on tonight, Jim Campbell. And this is kind of turning the tables because Jim has interviewed me for several of his shows many times, probably five or six times. He's a radio host in Greenwich, but he's also a nationally syndicated business radio host. And he has on his show incredible people. Jim, I have no idea how you get those guests on your show, but I'm honored to be among them. And Jim is writing a new book, which is due to come out next year, called Madoff Talks. And of course, it's a very intriguing topic, especially since we're all in the New York metro area, and Bernie Madoff was a big, big story and probably still is. So, but Jim, in order to have this email correspondence with him, he must have been aware, and you must have been aware, that people are, other than the two of you, are reading the emails.
Yes.
So was he holding back at all, or was he?
No, and I should also supplement. He wrote me long, 6, 7, 8-page, single-spaced, handwritten letters, beautiful penmanship, and which were also included. And an interesting story about that. He wrote to Andy and the fiance who I just told you about, and she gave it to me, a one-sentence letter saying, Andy and Catherine, I'm so very sorry, and Dad. Not even love, but that's what he wrote, an apology. Mm. The same, which obviously I didn't know about until she gave me several years later. The same time, he's apologizing to his son. He's writing a guy he does not know, 7-page, single-spaced, basically, I don't say mea culpa because it wasn't, but his side of the story.
Yeah.
Which actually shows you, you know, where his mind, mind was at. Now, I'll say the prison warden was obnoxious, to be honest. He blocked me visiting him. He blocked us emailing after a while, saying that I was a security risk. And he wouldn't. I appealed it. He turned me down. And I finally said, "Okay, I interview and I know our senators in Connecticut, and one of them's on the Judiciary Committee, oversees the Department of Justice, and I'm going to go right to them." And magic, it was turned back on instantly. Mm-hmm. But I didn't get as much as I wanted just because the warden blocked me. But if you read the stuff that Bernie sent, he was not holding back. In any way, and they didn't censor him in any way that I know of. They didn't block any of his letters. They didn't change anything, you know.
So Jim, what was your overall impression? I mean, let's kind of start there. I mean, this was he a brilliant guy gone wrong? Was he a sociopath? Was he? There's almost nobody in the middle. Everybody's very polarized about their view of Bernie Madoff. So now you've got him up close, and is he trying to seduce you? Is he trying to be straightforward? Like, what's that all about?
Interesting point. You know, I interviewed a fraud, a woman that's an expert on Wall Street fraud, white collar fraud, and involved in the Madoff story in the sense that she evaluated him. And she said that he must have viewed me as his self-appointed guardian of his reputation. In other words, I was going to help rehabilitate him in his mind. He had another goal, of course, too, which is he wanted to restore the reputation of his sons and Ruth, right? Mm. So in his mind, he wanted to restore his reputation and their reputation. Now, was he a sociopath? It's really an interesting thing about him. Is that he gets involved in a Ponzi scheme, right? And the basic story he told me, which, by the way, he hasn't really told outside of me very much, was that he's running this business. And people will find out in the book, he was an incredibly successful Wall Street guy. He built the NASDAQ system, which is essentially integrating the exchanges and the markets for OTC stocks and non off New York Stock Exchange stocks, hugely impressive, broke the monopoly of the New York Stock Exchange, became one of the lead brokers for what you call discount brokerage firms like Schwab and, of TD Trade and all that kind of stuff. So he's built a great business, right? So the logical story that he tells you does seem logical, which is I got in trouble. I got in a bad trade. I made a classic gambler's mistake. I'll double down and I'll pay it off. So I'll do a Ponzi for a bit of time and fix everything, right? And that makes sense. It's, dumb sense or illegal sense or a bad mistake, but at least makes sense. As I unravel the whole story, that doesn't end up being the truth. Mm. The truth is, and people will get all the details out of the book, he was actually building at the market making business, right, which is what he was in, essentially buying stocks as a middleman, was not only completely honest, it was way above the Wall Street norm for ethics. Mm-hmm. Customers were put first. There was no front running, which is rampant on Wall Street. Yeah. And he fought internally to his compliance. There was to be no infractions whatsoever. Any infraction were reporting to the SEC right away. Okay. So this is coming out of this guy's head. Built it, brilliant, architected, and totally honest. The same time, he's running a Ponzi scheme two floors down below. Since basically the business was started. Now, it is unfathomable. You'll see my sort of analysis on how I put it together. The book ends with the chapter before the end, putting Bernie on the couch, essentially. And you can already see this is fascinating because it would have been a lot easier to say he got himself in trouble, got into a Ponzi scheme, blah, 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 right? Or he's a complete sociopath and, psychopath and happened. But he ran a legitimate business. He was incredibly generous to his employees. Ended up not being some of his own money, but he would pay for his employees' honeymoons. He'd pay for medical bills. He ran the firm as a family. He had his sons running what became the 19th floor, the market making clean business, and the Ponzi business was on the 17th floor behind locked doors that his own sons, who ran the major business, didn't even have access to. So I don't know, how a guy's mind, the criminal mind, could work. And he was so brilliant that he had a firm of, say, 250 people. He had the guys that were working on the 17th floor that were involved in the Ponzi scheme. There's not a single person in the entire business who knew he was running a Ponzi scheme. And these were guys working for 40 years there.
That must have required an incredible amount of energy.
That's a great point. I would talk to the forensic guys, the detectives came in and unraveled the whole thing, right? Which is really cool. There's a whole section on how they reverse engineered Madoff's brain, as I call it. And we both sit around and say, Jesus, this guy's so brilliant. He could have been Bill Gates. And he was, in a sense, Bill Gates on Wall Street. The extent, the cover up, the details, every angle covered, no stone left unturned. It's exhausting, digesting what he did. And you ask yourself why. Let me tell you another thing. His business at peak was in demand. The Wall Street firms were buying the market making and the specialist firms. And his firm was potentially worth $3 billion, right? Excluding the Ponzi scheme. Mm. $3 billion. But he couldn't sell it because the Ponzi scheme was part of the same legal structure, right?
Yeah.
So due diligence would have unraveled that as opposed to if it was in a special or separate subsidiary. So he ran a business worth $3 billion that he couldn't realize the value of because he was cheating in part of it, that he didn't need to be cheating at.
So he was stuck. I mean, once it's that entangled, there's no elegant way out. And I guess it's somewhere in his mind, he thought that the only thing he could do was make it bigger. Because he couldn't figure out
how
to make it smaller and get out.
Yeah, he couldn't figure out how to get out. He couldn't. He didn't have the courage to do it. And I'll just throw one more psychological thing at you that's mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. A guy who runs a Ponzi scheme is putting all the money in his own pocket. He had his big four investors, as he called them, and I come to call them in the book. One of them, he made seven times richer than himself. Now, try to fathom that. He ran the Ponzi scheme. He took on all the illegalities, and he made somebody else seven times more than he made, and that number is $7 billion.
Is that the guy who lived in Florida and he passed away and they disgorged?
Yeah, it's the guy drowned in a swimming pool. A guy named Jeffrey Pickhauer.
Jeffrey, exactly.
And they
disgorged the money.
Real sleazebag.
But they disgorged the money from his widow, right? Wasn't that what happened?
They disgorged $7.2 billion from his widow, and he was probably worth $9
billion. Wow.
So he wasn't left penniless. So basically, he had huge leverage over Madoff. And it's not generally understood because Madoff is viewed as the Wizard of Oz right behind the curtain who did all this stuff and was the bad guy, made all the money, stole all the money. And in fact, he had a legitimate business and he had investors he made richer than he were who were essentially extorting and blackmailing him. Yeah, makes for a good story, by the way.
Jim, the book's going to come out next summer, so in a year from now.
Well, in 2021, I hope before next summer.
Okay, so in 2021, and so this is really a sneak peek. We'll have you on Criminal Justice Insider podcast when the book breaks, so we'll be able to get it.
Thank you very much.
Up to date, but let's assume that Bernie Madoff survives long enough in prison because he's apparently, according to his lawyers, at least. He's. They said he only has 18 months left to live.
Right.
But let's assume he lives long enough to get a copy of the book and to read it. What do you think that he will think about your book?
Well, first of all, I say that he accepted the terms that I wrote it on, and he's probably not going to be very happy with the results. Mm. And I don't even know if at this stage of his life, what his health is, will he read a 400-page book? And I don't know. It's one of the things I talk about the forensic guy is, hey, Bernie, it's over. It's done. Admit what the frig you did. He still won't admit that it was a Ponzi scheme from day one, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't think that'll ever change. I think he'll feel I let him down. I don't really know. He may like the stuff about his family that, if they come out of Chapter 8 in one piece, which people will find out when they read it. But I don't know. And obviously, I'll send him a book if he's still alive. I sent him somebody else wrote a book, and I can't remember now who it was. But Helen Chapman, who you may know.
Yeah.
I sent him Helen's book, and he read it. He ripped her to shreds. But Bernie's never going to... He's never complained to himself, I don't believe.
I think people would be comforted and would be attracted to your book knowing that he might not like it. That you strive to tell the truth.
And people will find that out. Trust me, there's no apologia. For Madoff and the fact that it's Madoff talks, it's going to come out pretty. I personally, when I was doing it, I thought he was going to come out better, right? Because I was hearing all of his side and he was admitting the criminal stuff and all this other stuff he was telling me. Unfortunately, it didn't hang together. So he's not going to come out well, because of that. And, I really appreciated that, for instance, the victims knew I was talking to him, right?
Yeah.
And obviously, and none of them had any problem because they knew me by then that I'm going to call it straight. I wasn't going to stick up for Madoff. Mm. Now, to be honest, I wouldn't really, Madoff Talks is what I named the book, right? But that was when I started with Madoff, right? By the time I'd learned the whole story and all the systemic stuff, I really honestly wouldn't use that title because I think it does give what you say. But, McGraw-Hill, that's what they want. So.
Yeah,
they're the boss.
I've been involved in that so often. I get asked to speak, and then I say, "What's the topic?" And they say, "Well, we just want the blood and guts."
Yeah,
and I said, "Yeah, well, I've spent I'm home 13 years from prison. I've done all this great stuff." And they go, "Yeah, we don't really want to know that. We want the blood and guts."
See, they're going to find out, which they don't really know yet. My editor, is, you know, when they hear you're going to write about the SEC's failure, who cares about it? That's boring stuff. They're going to find that story unbelievable. The incompetence, it's just the story. That is awesome. They'll find J.P. Morgan. They'll find the feeder fund stuff. They're going to find all that stuff almost beyond belief. So I think they'll be interested. Now, one thing that's going to be interesting is that my mind can kind of absorb that. And I think there's a feeling that the average guy really wants a very concise one main storyline. And obviously you can tell this has got some multiple storylines, some sublines. So it'll be interesting to see if McGraw-Hill digests the whole thing and if the market is able to digest that. But I wouldn't really be capable of writing a totally simplistic, black and white story. And apparently that's what a lot of people like to read. The other thing was they don't think people read anymore more than 200 pages, which blows me away. You know, I said, this is an investigative book on Madoff. You can't do what I wanted to do in 200 pages, So we'll find out if people will read 400 pages or not.
Yeah.
If not, Jeff, I hope you'll buy 10,000 copies yourself.
Yeah, it'll be certainly interesting to see if how people picture Madoff in order to buy the book. Is it the Richard Dreyfuss Madoff? The De Niro Madoff? I mean, and this is an impossible story to encapsulate in a 2-hour movie, for example.
By the way, this probably surprise you. I have not watched either of those. I didn't want to. I felt like once I was inside the family that I didn't really have no interest in it. So in the book, I have a response from Bernie on the Dreyfuss one. And he refutes all the stuff that's in there about, that he hit his brother apparently and stuff like that. And he hung his brother out to dry, Peter Madoff. But I have never watched him and I'm not really going to watch him. So we'll see.
Jim, thank you so much. This is, this was a great, great conversation.
Would you like to host your own radio program or podcast? Park City Productions 06604 is a Bridgeport, Connecticut-based radio broadcast solutions company. Follow us on Instagram, like us on Facebook, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. That's Park City Productions 06604. Call us at 203-522-8801.
We're excited to announce that Jim Campbell Radio has now been unveiled on YouTube. You search Jim Campbell Radio. When you get there, please subscribe. You'll get all our updates. Content is regularly updated. And Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell and Business Talk with Jim Campbell, all of our podcasts are right there for you. All of this new consolidated data content updated regularly. Jim Campbell Radio.
This is Bill O'Shaughnessy. I think you're going to like this one. I interview so inartfully, awkwardly, and imprecisely, as you well know. Today we're talking with a master interviewer. I've been interviewed by him. His name is James Campbell, and he comes from a Connecticut station. He's up in Vermont. He's in a station near Yale. He's all over New England, and he's written a book. And you won't believe, where'd you get the idea for doing a book out? What's that guy's name?
I think it's Bernard L. Madoff.
Yeah.
People Bernie may have heard of him. Bernie Madoff.
I love it.
Biggest Ponzi scheme in history, and I'll tell you how it happened. I was doing an interview with a woman that wrote a book that Andrew Madoff, who was his son and girlfriend, cooperated with. So I said, before you come on, can I interview Andrew, which would be off the air because he couldn't talk. This is son, Andrew, who was the younger son. The other son committed suicide, and Andrew died of leukemia. But so we spoke on the phone off the air. And I said, I think so far that you're innocent. And he said, and then we're going to be live tomorrow. I asked him some tough questions, which he answered off the record. And then the next day, I said, I'm going to say on the air that I think you did not know. And he says, I'm going to listen to see if you do that. And I did it. And then he introduced me to his mother, Ruth, who I became friends with. Mm. And then Ruth introduced me to Bernie in prison. And that's how this whole thing...
You visited him in prison?
I have not visited him. I have 300 pages of communications, and I have the most extensive media relationship with him, is how he describes it. And he's a brilliant guy. And unfortunately, the more that I'm had done research on the book, a lot of what he says hasn't turned out to be true.
Bernie Madoff. When is this book coming out, Jim?
The earliest it'll be out will be mid-2020.
And what's the title?
It is Madoff Talks, Uncovering the Truth Behind the Biggest Ponzi Scheme in History.
Tell me about Bernie Madoff. You've exchanged a lot of, his family. Was he just a bad guy?
He's actually a low-key guy. He's actually comes across as very friendly and personable. The problem with Bernie is that he cannot accept any level of defeat or anything. Hmm. So he goes overboard on stuff, and that's what led him to do all kinds of nefarious stuff. He had some big investors who actually made much more money than he did over time, and he couldn't say no to them. And I mean, they would literally, down to the level of, they would call up and say, I'd like this backdated to this, I want this level of profit and this gain, or the other way, I want this loss for my taxes, and all made up. And so what Bernie told me initially was that he lost some money in 1992 because of these guys. Instead of calling them on it, he took the loss and then doubled up on Ponzi money. The truth has ended up, unfortunately, being, since he's in business in the end of the 60s, on that illegal side of the business, there was never any real trading. It was a complete fraud from day one, which kind of boggled my mind.
Jim Campbell, who made money off Bernie Madoff?
The number one guy was a guy named Jeffrey Pickauer, who made $7.2 billion off of Madoff and had to give it all back. But Bernie, never even worth over $1 billion. So there's an interesting thing. Most Ponzi schemes, the guy at the center is making all the money, which tells you that it was not about greed. It's about ego and power and an inability to say no. And the guy, let me tell you, unbelievably brilliant mind. The front side of his business was called a market-making business, and what that meant was if Schwab was looking to do trades, they would route them through Bernie's shop so that Bernie did the order execution and everything, and Schwab had the customer out front. Totally legitimate, totally honest, overboard on Wall Street ethics. Ends up being like a mafia business. It was like the restaurant out front. Mm. And back here, completely illegal. So,
what does this say, Jim Campbell? You're a broadcaster, now an author. What does it say about this country that we almost worship guys who make money?
It's and the next point to there is that we want to believe con men. We want to believe that he could be this wizard, that he could defy the market, that he never lost money, that every year he made money. And part of that blame goes with us because it was too good to be true. And we tend to believe too good to be true. The other thing it doesn't say well about our country, which is part of the themes in my book, which is the regulatory agencies all let us down. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of investors, mom and pop, who put 30 years of their life savings in, who were not rich, and they thought that the SEC had blessed him. They thought, the FDIC protects your money in the bank. The equivalent in the brokerage business is SIPC, S-I-P-C. Turns out SIPC doesn't cover Ponzi schemes. So I lost money. Don't I get like the FDIC would do if a bank went bankrupt? So the system let people down, too.
What about smart guys like Joe Perella? And I've mentioned Mike Bloomberg, the Solomons, how come they didn't blow the whistle on this guy?
I think they didn't blow the whistle just because it's not really what's done on Wall Street, to turn somebody else. All these guys know all the bad stuff that's going on behind the scenes. And, even these legitimate firms do a lot of sleazy stuff.
Wasn't he, Jim Campbell, wasn't Bernie Madoff promising returns of 15% no matter what?
Yeah.
Everybody else says, I'll give you 3%.
He was towards the end, right? It was 11%. It was 1% a month, basically. Basically, no matter what happened to the market, it was 1%. And here's what he did for his big guys. The big guy would send him money, a lot of money, and sometimes help bail him out.
What do you mean the big guy? 10 million? 50 million?
The $7 billion was the biggest guy.
$7 billion
that made up. But what he was doing for them was, when you're at Ponzi, you have to keep getting more money or you're out. And this guy would sometimes give him money if he was short. So in return, Bernie would give him 30% returns. Where was that 30% coming? From the poor guy over here who'd given him money who was only getting 11. He was taking that guy's money and giving it to him, and then you got to bring in more. That's a pretty good deal for Pickhauer, which is the guy's name.
The book is called Bernie Madoff. Is that what it is?
Madoff Talks, Uncovering the Truth Behind the Biggest Ponzi Scheme in History.
Say again.
Madoff Talks, Uncovering the Truth Behind the Biggest Ponzi Scheme in History.
And it'll be out in about 6 months?
In mid-August.
Good for you. And you got a high-class publisher, I hear.
McGraw-Hill. Very nice people.
And the author is Jim Campbell.
Very nice. And I hope to be half the writer you are.
Well, I struggle with it. Thank you, Jim Campbell, broadcaster, author. And that should be a hell of a book, Bernie Madoff. All the Secrets. Thank you. Great stuff.